I want to express my thoughts and appreciation to Richard for conducting my class while I was gone. Again, the brethren here, I think, are quite blessed to have men like Richard and Chris and others in the congregation, and you know who you are, that do good work, and so blessed, and that's such a blessing to all of us in our work and labors as we labor together in God's kingdom. I understand that you are discussing lesson number 18, a review of the book of Joshua. It's important, I believe, when you introduce a book to have a good feel for the book, to know about the things that you're going to be studying, and then, of course, in the period of the discussion, and then after the discussion, a review of the book to see what we remember, and what we've learned through our study. And so that's lesson number 18 in your lesson book, on page number 73. You've been going through that, I understand, and you have discussed the people who lived or inhabited the land of Canaan. And, of course, here is a map, and we see them identified in Deuteronomy chapter 7, in verse 1, the Hittite, the Girgashite, the Amorites, the Canaanite, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And we know that from the promise that was made unto Abraham. Initially, where in the text do we read of this land being promised unto Abraham? Genesis chapter 12, initially, and then the identification of these peoples, where, as God continued to speak to Abraham, defining the land. It's there, but back earlier in Genesis chapter 15. We saw that. These people, the Ites, as I sometimes refer to them, you'll see them there. And also you'll note this list, or a good sampling of this list, found in the book of Nehemiah. Now, the reason why that's so important, Randy, if you don't mind, check me on that. I believe it's Nehemiah chapter 9. We should be in the neighborhood of about verse 13, 14, long in through there. Nehemiah chapter 9. The time frame of that is so important because Nehemiah affirms that the promise that God made relative to the land during the time of the restoration, Nehemiah says, God did it. Is it chapter 6? Or chapter 9, verse 8. Okay, I missed the verse. So we've got the affirmation of Nehemiah that God did what he said he would do. Because he said, thou art righteous. Thank you for that. But we see them identified on the map. If you'll look quickly, the locations of the inhabitants of the land as they were during the time of the conquering of the land. All right? Any questions or comments? Of course, the Jebusites were not completely driven out of the city of Jerusalem. The Canaanites were not completely driven out. And, of course, consequences ensued as a result of that. You were discussing the list of the sons of Jacob, and you see these identified on the board. If you want to find a good passage where they're listed together, just commit to memory Genesis chapter 35, because that list tells us the names of the sons and the mothers from which they were born, and that's a good list. They're listed at other places, but that's a good place to find the list and to know the sons' mothers. All right? Here we find them again, and then the places of settlement on the map. You talked about this, I believe, last Sunday morning. Is that correct? And look probably at these very maps. The differences in the two lists, somebody want to tell me? All right, that was the priesthood, and then, of course, Joseph's sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, Joseph being the favorite son, his sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, received a double portion. Why was Levi not given a specific territory among the tribes? You've talked about that. God was their portion, yes. Now, I was just briefly talking with Richard about these six cities of refuge. You have studied that there were 48 cities that were given to the Levites, and you've discussed why they received these cities of refuge, and you've talked about what the cities of refuge were. And you see six of them identified on this particular map. I don't think, yes, this map is on the list that you presented, I believe. But you'll note in Joshua chapter 7 or chapter 20, six of these cities are identified, and I want to particularly call your attention to three on west side of the Jordan, and three in the Trans-Jordan side. Now, there was a reason why these cities, these 48 cities of refuge, were located where they were. Do you remember why they were so scattered out throughout the land? All right, so they could reach a city of refuge. Now, as we consider that just a little bit further, we note that there were six cities of refuge specifically that were promised, three on each side of the Jordan. And I want to call your attention to this in Numbers chapter 35. Numbers chapter 35, the significance of six being identified on each side of the Jordan is evidence that all of the land that God had promised unto Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob was indeed possessed by the nation of Israel. In chapter 35, beginning in verse 9, there the text says, "And Jehovah spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, when ye pass over the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then ye shall appoint you cities to be cities of refuge for you, that the manslayer that killeth any person unwittingly may flee thither. And the city shall be unto you for refuge from the avenger, that the manslayer die not until he stand before the congregation for judgment. And the cities which ye shall give shall be for you six cities of refuge, and ye shall give three cities beyond the Jordan, and three cities ye shall give in the land of Canaan. They shall be cities of refuge for the children of Israel and for strangers, and for the sojourner among them shall these six cities be for refuge, that everyone that killeth any person unwittingly may flee thither." Now, there were 48 cities given unto the Levites, six of these designated as cities of refuge, three on one side and three on the other side of the Jordan. Notice, if you will, that three were given on one side of the Jordan, with three more promised according to Deuteronomy. And Randy, if you don't mind to have this ready for me, verses 7 through 9, promised contingent upon their taking all the land. Now that becomes important to our study. Deuteronomy chapter 19, verses 7 through verse 9. You have that for me, please? All right, now we've talked about the importance of understanding that the promise was indeed fulfilled. How many of you have ever talked with someone who is of a premillennial background, who believes that the second coming of Christ, there's going to be some kind of a mass transportation of Jews to the land of Palestine, and they affirm that God has not yet fulfilled the promise that He made unto Abraham? You've ever heard that argument? Okay, you want to know this. Because if we can identify the six cities of refuge, three on one side and three on the other side, you draw the line and the conclusion is what? What was the condition of having six? It's been accomplished. That's right. So you just add this to your list of ammunition if you talk to someone who's premillennial and see what kind of response you get. The very fact that six cities of refuge are named helps us to understand clearly that God did indeed give them all the land, which he had promised to give unto Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Question? I just turned past it. Let me get back to it. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. These. Kadesh, Shechem, and Hebron, and then these. Bezer, Ramoth-Gilead, and Golan. Okay. Well, let me go back here. It's in Joshua chapter 20, I think. Let me get to it. Joshua chapter 20, the six are named, beginning in verse 7 through 8. 7 through 9. Yeah. And Deuteronomy is the condition. Three given in well, I've got that backwards, Chris. Three given in the Transjordan, with three more promised, if all of the land is fulfilled. Yes. And the fact that we read in Joshua chapter 20, verses 7 through 8, of the six being named, is evidence that all of the land was given. I think that these were the first ones that were given. And then, according to this, the text of Deuteronomy. And then three... No, I've not said that right yet. I'm sorry. Three in the Transjordan, according to what I have here, with three more promised if God fulfilled all of the land promised unto the fathers. Does that make sense? Did I get it right that time? Maybe. Yeah. Oh, yes. I'm sorry. That's correct. Yes, that's correct. Yeah, that was the conditional passage, yes, before they came into the land. I'm a little foggy this morning. I appreciate your patience. Deuteronomy 19, 7 through 9. Deuteronomy. 19. Yes, 7 through 9. We might look at that and say, well, that's evidence that we really don't need because we have the evidence of Joshua's statement in Joshua 21 and Joshua 23. But I like all the evidence that exists, if I can load my gun with all of it. And this is just additional evidence that all of the land was given that God had promised, or we wouldn't have all of the cities named. Conditions have been met. Okay? Very good. Any other questions or comments? All right? Well, very quickly, we'll look through these. The six cities named, there it is, concludes that Joshua had accomplished his task. Why does Joseph's name not appear on the map of the tribes? John? All right, his sons received the double portion. The land was given to Manasseh and Ephraim for their inheritance. Reuben was Jacob's oldest son. Why did he not receive the double portion? Now, that was the promise that was made to the oldest son, to get double portion. What happened with Reuben? Yes. All right, now you're thinking of Esau, Jacob and Esau and the relationship, and it was Esau that did that. But Reuben, the oldest son of Jacob, the firstborn of Leah, forfeited his, I guess we would call it, birthright because of sin that he committed. Does somebody know what that was? All right, Melissa? All right, he defiled his father's bed. We can go back and read what happened. If you'll go back to Genesis chapter 35, Genesis chapter 35, I had, frankly, forgotten this little tidbit of information in my study until I came across this again. But in Genesis chapter 35, in verse 22, it says, "It came to pass while Israel dwelt in that land, that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard of it. Now the sons of Jacob were 12." And of course we see the list that we mentioned a few moments ago here in chapter 35, but I had allowed it to escape my memory, verse 22. And so we see the sin that Reuben committed. All right, he lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine. All right, any questions or comments? Yes. It was wrong for Reuben to have his father's concubine. And concubinage, by the way, there's an era of history here that I don't know answers to questions that I ask. When you look at Abraham, for example, Abraham had Hagar. That was not according to the plan of God. That was a departure from God's plan. But yet we do not see severe consequences imposed upon Abraham as a result of what he did. That's not specifically addressed and said this is the consequence of what you did. Yet we do see consequences imposed upon Hagar and upon Ishmael and then the descendants. We see God's plan, and this is an interesting thing that you've brought up. God's plan for marriage, of course, described in Genesis chapter 2, but it wasn't very long afterward till we see a departure from God's plan about marriage. Look, if you will, in Genesis chapter 4, just another tidbit of information that sometimes we have forgotten. When you turn back to Genesis chapter 4, we typically look at that chapter of Cain and Abel, right? But as you read down through that chapter, after Cain is cursed, and he goes into the land of Nod, you'll read beginning in verse 18, it tells us, "And unto Enoch was born Irad, and Irad begat Mahuyiel." Pronounce that for me, Richard, please. I'm sorry, Genesis 4, the father of Methuselah. "And Methuselah begat Lamech." Then verse 19, "Lamech took unto him two wives." Now here in the beginning it was stated that Lamech took two wives. That was displeasing to God. As far as consequence are concerned, direct consequence, we're not told what that was. But what Reuben did in taking a concubine was contrary to what God's will was, but he took his father's concubine, which amplified the sin that he committed. And, of course, is cited as a reason why he didn't receive a portion in the land. Double portion. True. And, of course, in New Testament times, we have noted from Acts chapter 17 that there was a time of ignorance that I won't say was tolerated, but during that time of ignorance, the direct consequence of sin was not imposed to the extent of just wiping man out. We see further evidence of that, I think, in Acts chapter 14, where that's just not addressed. And I think the reason for that is clear, clearly revealed in Acts chapter 17. God looked past that. Some translations use the expression overlooked, and that word doesn't mean to ignore. It carries the meaning of look over, or to look past. It's unfortunate the King James translates that expression that God winked at, the connotation that carries to us is that it was minimized, wasn't all that important. And that's just not true. God was looking past that to the time when His Son would die in order that those sins might be forgiven, the scheme of redemption might be fulfilled. No, it is not. It is not. And it does leave questions open-ended from the standpoint of not being answered. We have questions, but the answer isn't revealed to us because God looked past that time rather than to focus our attention upon those immediate consequences. We pass that time, the time of the coming of the Redeemer. Okay, but our question here has to do with Reuben. And though Reuben was Jacob's oldest son, the firstborn of Leah, and the one, by the way, that took up for Joseph, and we might commend him in that respect, but yet he went in unto his father's concubine and defiled his father's bed. And that was definitely noted. Well, that's right. And as far as the revelation of the scheme of redemption is concerned, those points pale to the background of importance for us to know. And that's why, of course, we cite Deuteronomy 29, verse 29, the things that are revealed belong to us. The things that are not revealed belong to God. What He did about that and His thinking about that, we're just simply not told, and we have to leave that open-ended. We can ask questions about it. So forth, but we can't answer them with information that's not revealed. Nor can we be presumptive based on the absence of information.
Because I get, that's one of the questions I get sometimes when I'm talking about people, and they like to go back to the Old Testament, and they focus in on the violence and the war and how the people, especially at this time, came in and took over something that wasn't even, I mean, they just took it. And they say, well, how can God be a good, kind, generous God if He
Well, that's true. And of course, I know we're drifting here a little bit in our subject, but that's okay for our point. When we look at things like that, we need to perhaps have some kind of an answer that is revealed in mind. You remember when God spoke to the father of the nation, Abraham, and He told him that this land is going to be yours 400 years from now, because the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet full. God gave the Amorite opportunity after opportunity after opportunity to repent, and they continued to pursue in yonder direction. And finally, God's judgment came upon them. Now, we see that to be true not only with the Amorite, where He used the Israelite to conquer them and to inflict punishment upon the Amorite, while at the same time blessing the Israelite and fulfilling His promise that He made to Abraham and developing a nation of people through whom the Messiah would come. The providence of God is seen emphatically in that. And then, of course, when you follow down through the hundreds of years of the history of the Israelites and discuss the Assyrians, God said through the prophet Isaiah, in Isaiah chapter 10, verse 1, that they will be the instrument of My wrath upon the Israelites. So God raised up Shalmaneser, the king of the Assyrians, to conquer the northern 10 tribes of Israel. And then, of course, the couple of maps that I especially like to use that shows that little dot of Judah during the reign of Hezekiah, where Sennacherib, the next king of the Assyrian Empire, was not successful in conquering Judah, because Hezekiah remained faithful to God. And then when he went home, his sons killed him. And then we have the raising of the Babylonian Empire that conquers the Assyrian Empire, and then comes down and conquers Judah, because we now have another king on the throne that's unfaithful. And you see in this sequence of kings the fulfillment of prophecy that God made to Daniel in Daniel chapter 2 regarding these King Nebuchadnezzar and then the Cyrus, the king of the Medes and the Persians, and then Alexander, and then the Roman kingdom, and then in the days of these kings, he said, I'll set up my kingdom. So we've got the sequence of kings, but God using the decisions that men made to accomplish his purposes. Even when, as he said, the stout heart of the Assyrian, it was not in his mind to do this. But he did it anyway because that's the use that God had for him. He thought he was just conquering kingdoms. He didn't realize that he was in the hand of God, being the instrument of God to accomplish these things. So the answer to the question, I think, you know, when we look at God and say, well, he destroyed these nations, and he did so, he just went in there and told his people to kill them all. Yeah, he did. And why? Because he had tolerated their iniquities for years and years and years and years, and they did not repent. And when we think of the Assyrians, for example, Jonah was the prophet of God sent to call upon them to repent. And they refused. Well, they accepted his teaching then, but then later refused. So God destroyed them. So there's a reason for that. It's not that he went in among a bunch of great folks and said, no, I like these people better, and you're gone, wipe them out. It was because of their sin. Yes, and of course, a lot to be said about that. When we think about the goodness of God, to the extent that he would send his only beloved Son to die for us, you can't have the goodness of God without the severity of God. A God who could love so much that he sent his Son could not love in that capacity without hating the things that caused it. So, lots to be said about that. I think sometimes we only want to look at one side. Larry, and then David, please. That's right. That's right, and that speaks to the character of God. Exactly. David? We sometimes use it that way, but technically, no. The Canaanites were a nation of people that came, if memory serves me correct, I believe from, was it Crete? We talked about that, I think, in the beginning. Wasn't it Crete that they descended from and came down in, and settled in this portion, upper portion of the land that we commonly refer to as the land of Canaan? I say commonly referred to, you understand. We look at that and we say Palestine. That's the land of Palestine. But we know that the Philistines, as it were, and so forth, they were a group of people that were located on the map. But yet we... Was it the Philistines that were from Crete? The Canaanites then came from further up. I've forgotten where. Check some of our earlier maps as we discuss that. I have forgotten exactly where then they came from. True, right. And I think they descended, if memory serves me correctly, from up high on the map in the area of Mount Ararat, maybe perhaps a little bit north and west of there. Yes. Rahab. Yeah, and so here we go again. And we're going to look at that, especially so in the period of Judges, about 300 plus years, 15 times around the horn. Yeah. Okay. Right. Right. I believe this map here, Gaza, yeah, over by the sea. Yeah. Here's the land. Yes, Lisa. Oh, okay. Oh, okay. 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 Okay, I was remembering that kind of mixed up, but got the gist of it. Okay, here's the Canaanites on our map, David, where they eventually settled into the land. But it helps us, I think, to see that there were others there too, so to characterize all of this as Canaanites would technically not be correct, although we often do that. We refer to this as the land of Canaan, and that's a good way to do it. Okay? Yeah. 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 Okay. Well, that's good. See, you guys got this nailed down. It's really good. This is a good study. All right. How did the Gibeonites trick the Israelites into making a treaty with them? Joshua chapter 9. Jenny? That's well put. When they said they had come from a really long distance, how far had they actually come? About 10 miles. Yeah, about 10 miles. Well, not all that far. Now, when Joshua and his army had this encounter with the Gibeonites. The city of Gibeon was about 10 miles from Bethel or so. We see that they conquered Jericho, then Ai, and then Bethel, and then they went back to Gilgal where their encampment was. Now, Gilgal was a long, long way. How far was it from Gibeon? Maybe 15 miles. Okay. So, yeah, we've got these little towns all stretched across here together. And so their plan was not exactly true, you see. They had lied. And here we've got them coming from Gilgal to Jericho to Ai to Bethel and then down to Gibeon. Now, these fellows have traveled, they say, a long way. Wasn't that long, was it? Now, what had God said about making covenants with anybody in the land? Don't do it. Don't make any covenants. In fact, he said, don't take their sons to be your sons-in-laws. Don't give them to your daughters. And vice versa, don't make any kind of covenants with them. And now, this is exactly what they've done. Now, this particular map doesn't show us a large enough area, but and this one is not the map that I want. But when you look at your map, you'll note that Gibeon had enemies. And now that they have made this alliance with the princes of Israel, what is Joshua obligated now to do? All right, to honor that alliance. Oh, no, it doesn't. All right, Lynn's just about to tell us something. They did, yes. And what did that involve them in? War. Yes. You'll notice in chapter 10, the earlier part of chapter 10, that because they made this alliance with Israel, that Joshua leads in the battle against the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, and the king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon. And you'll notice, if you had a bigger map, that these are some of these city-states. Here's Eglon here, and too close to it, too far from it. Hebron is here, yes, thank you. And then Jarmuth. I'm not seeing it. Okay, should be in here somewhere. Okay, 71, page 71. Not all that necessary that we spend a lot of time on that, but the point being is that Joshua has engaged these other kings who have made an alliance against Gibeon because he's made an alliance with the Gibeonites, and so he defends them. All right, any questions or comments just here? In what order were the sections of land taken? Now, of course, we've got, look at this map, and I want to look at it in more detail. We've got them coming across the Jordan, facing the city of Jericho and Ai and so forth, and then going south in this campaign to fight against the enemies of the Gibeonites down in this area. And then they take their campaign northward and begin to fight and conquer the portion in the northern land of Canaan. I like this particular map because it displays the directions perhaps a little bit better. Upon crossing the Jordan, they encamped here in Gilgal and then moved to take the city of Jericho and Ai and then came back to Gilgal where their encampment was. This particular map, you probably have difficulty seeing it. I need to rework this. Joshua 1 through 8 is what you're reading here. And then the campaign goes over into what's referred to as the central portion of the land where they made the alliance with Gibeon. and then move into the valley of Ahalon and defeated these five kings that war against the Gibeonites. And that helps us down here. And then they return back to Gilgal. And then they go up and move against the city of Hazor. And we talked about Hazor and its size and so forth. I believe we said that by way of comparison, Jericho was about 7 acres that was encompassed by mighty walls. But the city of Hebron, memory is not working so well this morning, but I believe about 200 acres. Or was it 700? No, it's 200 acres, I believe. That was a walled city. And they conquered this city. Chapter 11, the land had rest from war. Okay? Now, just a trivia question here. When you look at this map, Joshua chapter 1 through chapter 11, you're reading of the conquering of the land. What does the rest of the book contain? The division of the land. That's right. So it naturally divides itself essentially into these two portions. Okay? All right. Why was Moses distressed when the tribes of Reuben and Gad asked for their inheritance? Numbers chapter 32. What was it that he thought they were about to do? Not help with all of it, right? He thought that they would go into their portion in the Transjordan side, and that would be the end of it. And that was not to be. He told them they could have that if what? If they helped conquer the rest of it. Now, when we read of the conquering of the land, of course, we have the Reubenites, the Gadites, and half-tribe of Manasseh involved in the battle. Now, when it's all over and done, what do? They go home. But they did fight. They fought through and took the land, and Joshua set it forth in chapter 1 that, yes, you can have your portion of the land if you'll fight and help your brothers to take the land. And after the land is conquered, you begin in Joshua chapter 22 and see them return to that land which had been given to them on the Transjordan side of the promised land. Where was the tabernacle set up? Joshua chapter 18. Where was the tabernacle set up? Shiloh. That's right. It was set up in Shiloh. Now what you're beginning to see is a more permanent fixture of Israel and the worship of God and so forth as they established themselves in the land. Where were Joseph's bones buried? Pardon me? All right, at Shechem. Now, Shechem was an important place in our history and geography study. Who first came to Shechem? Abraham. That's right. This was his first settlement when he came into the promised land and worked there as a shepherd, and of course eventually came on down to Hebron, where he and Lot, his nephew, separated, and Lot went down to the area of Sodom and Gomorrah, near the southern end of the Dead Sea. Joshua's bones, another thing of trivia, mathematician, John. Joshua's bones, Joshua. Joseph's bones. Where's he been all this time? All right. Can you give me some idea of how long they've been just toting Joseph around? At least 40 years, yes. At least 40 years. Now, we know that there was a period of time, we've discussed that, a period of time involved when Joseph yet lived after his father and family came down into the land of Goshen. And we've talked about that and talked about the age of Jacob and so forth. And then we talked about how enough time has lapsed for Joseph to die and a new Pharaoh to be on the throne that did not know Joseph, and for the people then to grow and multiply to the extent that this Pharaoh felt threatened and ordered the death of the little baby boys, trying to minimize the population of the Israelites. So we've got a long period of time involved here that Joseph has been being toted around. Now, yes, he was embalmed, but he was not buried. He was placed in a coffin. The last verse, I believe, of Genesis chapter 50 tells us that. Yes, now that's very important. I'm going to just throw this out because we don't have time to discuss it. This knowledge was written in what was called the books of the genealogy. And they were cared for very carefully for a reason. You remember the promise was in Deuteronomy chapter 30, before they ever went in and took the promised land, that when you worship other gods, God's going to take you into captivity. And when you repent, he will bring you back. And the word restoration, or the idea of restoration, is presented there in Deuteronomy chapter 30. And it's during the days of Ezra and Nehemiah that this restoration from captivity takes place. And you'll note in the book of Nehemiah that the books of genealogy are brought forth when it's time for the appointment of priesthood. It has to be done according to the books of the genealogy. And I believe that's in Nehemiah chapter, is it chapter 9? Yes, we will. Is it Nehemiah chapter 7? Yes, yes, that's it. Verse 5, Nehemiah 7, verse 5. The people are registered according to genealogy. So that's how we know who then is to be appointed as a Levite. And that's how we know who goes back to what portion of land where they're going to live. These books of genealogy were important. But in 70 A.D., what happened to those books of genealogy? They were destroyed when the Romans conquered the city of Jerusalem. So no Jew today possibly know what tribe he's from, and what does that say regarding him?